Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on Inside Europe, we are taking a break from the news to bring you a literature special. Honestly, I don't think we need an excuse for this, but in case anyone asks, we have a new Hungarian Nobel Prize in Literature, and over in Frankfurt, the world's biggest book fair is underway. And if you're still not convinced, please just think of the children.
Well, you can't not grow up with Pimpa. I mean, that's just unfair. And sad.
Stay tuned for an uncharacteristically joyful episode of Inside Europe.
The Nobel Prize in Literature for 2025 is awarded to the Hungarian author László Krasznahorkai for his compelling and visionary oeuvre that in the midst of apocalyptic terror reaffirms the power of art.
Yes, it is official. The 2025 recipient of the Nobel Prize for Literature is a European, a Hungarian to be precise. 71-year-old László Krasznahorkai's distinctive oeuvre is bleakly dystopian, melancholic, and at times very funny. And I can tell you that with confidence because I have spent much of the week binge reading his 1985 debut novel, Satan Tango. And also because a little bit earlier, I spoke to our Budapest correspondent, Stefan Boss, who told me how the Nobel judges explained their decision.
Well, the Nobel judges praised his artistic gaze, which is entirely free of illusion and which sees through the fragility of the social order combined with his unwavering belief in the power of art. That's how they were formulating it. And I think they have a point because his works include his debut Satan Tango, if I translate it in English, you know, Satan Tango in Hungarian, and that even inspired his friend, film director Béla Tarr, to turn it into a 7-hour film. Now, the film is known for its long shots of 2.5 minutes, and I think the film stayed faithful to his Satan Tango book. It takes place in a desolate, decaying Hungarian village after the fall of a failed collective farm, and that's also, I think, a metaphor for the collapse of both communism in the 1980s when he wrote it, and human hope. The residents live in mud, poverty, and moral paralysis, waiting for their meager pay and dreaming of escape. Now, that fragile work is, world, I should say, is shaken when Irimias, that was a man who they were believed was dead. Now, he returns with his companion, Petrina, and Irimias is really a charismatic, manipulative, and possible a con man, or even perhaps a devil figure. He promises salvation, urging the villagers to follow him and rebuild their lives elsewhere. Now, the novel unfolds as a dark, circular dance, the Satan Tango or the Satan Tango, and it's really also, I think, the text is structured like a tango with 6 steps forward and 6 steps back.
So Irimias, one of the sort of the things that enables him to cast this spell over the villagers is his command of language. And I found that so fascinating because he has these incredible sentences. There's even a bit quite late on in the book where clerks are given the job of trying to translate his sentences into sort of bureaucratic language, and they absolutely despair because they can't go home. And I just thought that was so interesting because the long sentence structure, it's also a feature of Krasznahorkai's writing. So there's almost a sense as though sort of the devil-like, sort of manipulative, charismatic quality that Irimias is imbued in, it's kind of also there in the novel and like the process of the novel writing itself.
Yes, indeed. It's a very good point because, you know, it's really through long swirling sentences that Krasznahorkai, shows the villagers' illusion and betrayals and perhaps spiritual emptiness. And I think what I recall is also, I think there was a sentence saying they didn't believe a word of what Irimiya said, but they listened because they had long forgotten how not to listen, how not to hope, how not to dream of something other than what they already had. You know, it's one of those beautifully written sentences I recall. So I think he's really a master of course, the Hungarian language, but also a master of explaining something in a beautifully written sentence. And that's something I think you don't see much nowadays.
Yeah, no, definitely unique. But I mean, those sentences, they did make me think a little bit of James Joyce and actually Irish and Russian authors, you know, that sort of sense of a novel in which there is a lot of mud, a lot of hopelessness, a lot of complaining, but also a lot of dreaming, right? Irish and Russian examples, Dostoevsky, for example, you know, came to mind there. And Kafka as well, in the sense that you have a world that is so completely realized that you don't question its logic. Its logic is insane, but you don't question it because it seems as though it has always been there. What has he said about his inspirations?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting point, because actually he grew up in the rural town of Gyula near Romania. I have been there, and I can tell you it's quite a very interesting town, still very much behind, perhaps, if you compare it to Budapest. But, you know, it obviously inspired him, but at age 18, he left his hometown of Gyula and has since lived in Germany, France, the United States, and Asia, experiences that have also deeply influenced his work. But he said there were also other impressions that made him decide to write Satan Tango. He says, I wrote Satan Tango while, among other things, working as a night watchman at a dairy farm. And when I had finished it, the manuscript somehow reached the then very popular young writer. His name was Peter Esterházy. Later we became very good friends, and he was the one who arranged for the book to be published. I told him that I had never thought that this book should be published. For me, the essential part was that it was written down on paper and out of my head. It was done. And I had no further wish for it.
It's so interesting, because this sort of idea of writing as a compulsion, there are characters in Satan Tango who have that, right? Who are writing their own things.
Yes, indeed.
Compulsively.
Yeah, and what is interesting, you know, he didn't even want his name there originally. Now, of course, eventually he agreed to publish his name. But, you know, he said, you know, he just wanted to get, basically he said, I wanted to get it out of my chest, you know. I wrote it down and that's it. But, of course, his friend had other plans. And now it was also interesting that after he wrote Satan Tango, he was apparently, you know, he had to read something from that book, and he had to present the book in Vienna. And then, according to him, he discovered that the rhythm in some sentences were not good, according to him. Eh? And he said, okay, then I have to write another book. And then, you know, the book came, The Melancholy of Resistance. And he said he tried to do a better job in some ways than in Satan Tango. And then, of course, he went on and on.
So a reluctant author, now perhaps also a reluctant Hungarian celebrity after last week's announcement. What's the reaction been in Hungary?
Well, it's very interesting. He has been a controversial figure by both praising and condemning the country of his birth, with his signature style, dressed in black and with wild hair and beard. He has long been a critic of the government of Prime Minister Viktor Orbán, accusing the leadership and even Hungarian society of shifting towards Russia and away from its Western home, while, what he said, wallowing in historical grievances like the 1920 Treaty of Trianon peace agreement that stripped the country of two-thirds of its territory and half of its population. He has even called the government a psychiatric case for not supporting Ukraine, despite the neighboring nation being invaded by Russia. Now, and at the beginning of the year, I recall that pro-government pundits basically lashed out at Krasnahorkai after he made critical comments about his home country to a Swedish outlet. Yet, of course, Hungarian politicians across the political spectrum praised Krasnahorkai's achievement now. They see the Nobel Prize as a triumph for the entire country, which takes pride in its unique language, I would say, and Hungarian literature. Prime Minister Orbán wrote on social media, for instance, "The pride of Hungary, the first Nobel Prize winner from Gyula, László Krasznahorkai, congratulations." Now, an opposition politician, Peter Magyar, who may become the next prime minister after the elections next year, according to the polls, now he offered a political perspective, noting that the best novels of Hungary's latest Nobel laureate depict the forgotten rural world and people oppressed by power. It was also interesting what comedian Tibor Boros said. He congratulated Krasnahorkai by quoting from his book, "You look terrible, don't even start a Krasnahorkai sentence. His longest sentence lasts 8 whole weeks, measuring 7 meters and 16 centimeters. A true sporting achievement."
Oh, wonderful. Well, I think it would definitely be to Krasnahorkai's taste if we were to end with that quotation, Stefan, because he's a funny guy, right? I mean, I had an interview with him where he was sort of asked about the sadness of his novels and, you know, the particular sort of Hungarian sadness. And he says, well, of course, you know, they're sad. We carry this great sadness in us as Hungarians. You know, it's why I'm so funny.
Yes, indeed, indeed. And I think, Hungarians have made sadness to a national art form, I think. So, yeah, that's also part of it.
Well, then, with laughter and with tears, Stefan Boss in Budapest, thank you so much for joining me to talk about László Krasznahorkai.
You're welcome.
Now, did I mention that it's the week of the Frankfurt Book Fair? The Frankfurter Buchmesse is not only the world's largest international book fair, it can also claim to be its oldest. That's if you trace its origins back 500 years to the Printers and Publishers Fair that became established sometime after the invention of the movable printing press in nearby Mainz. Our question is, who invented that printing press? Was it Martin Luther, Johannes Gutenberg, or Albrecht Dürer? Head on over to Spotify to take part in the poll. Also, I can now officially announce that, according to the results of last week's poll, Inside Europe listeners' favourite European snack is
gyros.
Congratulations, Greece, and thank you very much to our technical trainee, Ili, for that pronunciation. You're listening to Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock in Bonn. Filmmakers sometimes release a director's cut of a favourite movie. Well, I would like to invite you to think of what follows as something rather like that. It's actually a piece that we've aired before, but now with new and improved sound. So, in all its glorious anarchy, I am delighted to share again with you Danny Mitzman's tribute to Pimpa, the beloved Italian children's comic character who is celebrating her 50th birthday this year. A white dog with red spots, long floppy ears, and a penchant for adventure, Pimper's been Italy's answer to Paddington Bear for more than two generations. She's the star of her own eponymous comic and animated cartoon. Her creator, Altan, was in Bologna to open the touring exhibition Buon Compleanno Pimper, or Happy Birthday Pimper.
That is my daughter and her friends singing the Pimper theme tune, because everybody grows up with Pimper.
Oh, yeah, everybody. You can't not grow up with Pimper. I mean, that's just unfair and sad.
Who is Pimper to you then?
Oh, Pimper was like my best friend.
Pimper is a joyful, friendly, talking dog, white with big red spots and very long ears. She lives with Armando, a kind man with a big hat and a bigger moustache.
Il prato è ingiallito.
Perché non ha piovuto. Ora.
In Pimper's world, everything and everyone can talk. Other animals, trees and flowers, food and milk, the sun and the clouds, even the Hoover and the armchair.
Tu vai in bagno e di alla lavatrice di venire qui.
Eccomi.
Almost unknown outside Italy, Pimper truly is a national icon. Her creator is Francesco Tullio Altan, a well-known satirical cartoonist who's now in his 80s, known professionally simply as Altan. He tells me how Pimper was born way back in 1975 by pure chance.
I did drawings for my daughter, who was about two at the time. She would ask me to draw her various things, and one of them was the character of this little dog. We borrowed a family friend's nickname, and that's how she got her name.
At their stand at Bologna Children's Book Fair, Altan's surrounded by Pimper comic collections, merchandise and two new books to celebrate her 50th birthday. He's also surrounded by a swarm of adult fans who grew up reading Pimper. Her decades of success are something he says he never imagined.
No, because I didn't invent her for publication. It really was a private game between me and my daughter. Then, through a series of circumstances, a great friend, who was my agent at the time, took it to the Corriere dei Piccoli, which was an historic children's comic that no longer exists. They published her, and that's where the story began.
By 1987,
Pimper had her own monthly magazine and television cartoon series. When I ask Altan about Pimper's enduring popularity, he answers with endearing humility.
Frankly, I don't know. I think maybe since the character was born without being commissioned by a publisher, it's maintained a spontaneity or simplicity of approach that really works for children. Pimper's readers are very young, and over the last 50 years, little children haven't changed so much.
Nor has Pimper's world, which is refreshingly tech-free. There's a computer and a TV, but no mobiles, only an old-fashioned phone with a dial. Plus 7 pages of simple, classic kids' activities and games, like Spot the Difference, all created by Altan himself. A perfect mix my daughter Arianna adored. We had an annual subscription, and I remember Arianna's excitement every time a new issue arrived.
They had two little stories in them, and a bedtime story for your parents to read to you. And at the end there was a game and a page full of kids' drawings.
I think you learnt to read with Pimper.
Yeah, I did, because at one point Dad gave up on reading them to me. So I had to learn to read them. Every so often I still read them.
Arianna's friends also have fond Pimper memories, especially twins Melissa and Rebecca. Melissa remembers the excitement of seeing her drawing published in the gallery section. She tells me her grandma always bought it for her and she really loved reading all the stories. Rebecca recalls feeling happy whenever she read the comic. She says Pimper taught her kindness through the way she always helped her animal friends. As well as the stories, she liked the stickers, even if she admits she stuck them on really badly. And she loved the tear-out constructions, especially the flower, which her grandma still has.
E la pimpa
correva,
in the cartoons, I also used to love it when she would like go really fast. She would run or go somewhere really fast, and then her spots would fly off and go behind, like trail behind her, and then they'd, when she stopped, they'd go back on her. It was really fun. And yeah, I think Pimpa's really special because I grew up with Pimpa.
Altan reckons he's written around 1,200 stories about Pimpa and her friends, often inspired by those around him. A new character, a little yellow duck called Olivia, arrived 18 years ago with the birth of his granddaughter. Although he's never run out of stories, I wonder if he ever thinks about retiring.
Sometimes I think I could stop, but knowing there are still quite a few children who wait for her and who don't consider her as a character to read about, but as a friend and a playmate, I think it would be a horrible thing to tell them she's gone. So I keep going, as long as I can. I'll keep going.
Armando è uscito. Ha detto che quando torna farà le pulizie di primavera.
The stories usually follow a formula where Pimpa goes off for an adventure, then comes home to tell Armando all about it. When I asked Arianna's friends who their favourite character was, without hesitation, there was a unanimous
Armandone! Armandone! Armandone!
Ma perché Armandone?
Because Armandone gives a certain sense of security. He's there. He observes everything. He doesn't interfere much. He lets her do things, pretends to believe all the stories she tells him. I think he's a good father figure.
Non ingombrante.
Altan says Pimpa's not designed to be educational and his role isn't to teach. That said, does he want his young readers to learn something?
To learn to look at things in a certain way, perhaps, yes, but definitely not rules. Curiosity, for sure. To stimulate them, show them the possibility of an adventure, whether it's real or not. That's important.
Pimpa's tireless curiosity is matched by her respectful treatment of everyone and everything and her spontaneous kindness and generosity. It's a world away from the satirical political cartoons Altan draws for newspapers.
I don't know if it's my favourite world, but it's very useful for my mental balance. Sometimes, when reality becomes too disgusting, I take refuge there and I feel better because Pimpa's world is the world I wish existed.
A world which adults who grew up reading Pimpa also continue to love.
What makes me happy is that they also have children and things continue that way. Parents who read Pimpa when they were young can read it to their children in a different way from those who are discovering it for the first time. There's a little tradition that continues within the family. I think that's lovely.
Danny Mitzman, DW, Bologna.
Gira, gira il mondo, tipo gira il mondo anche la pimpa. Non me lo ricordo. Che la pimpa, ecco perché.
A big shout out to Danny Mitzman's daughter Arianna and her friends for bringing the joy of childhood stories to life for us in that report. Arianna, I would listen to your audiobook version of Pimpa anytime. If you would like to send us any feedback on that report or anything else in this programme, then the address is insideeurope@dw.com. You are listening to Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock, in Bonn. Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. Still to come over the next half hour, an Icelandic murder mystery in Tenerife, a poet-musician in Berlin, and a bike race in Slovenia that was only ever going to have one winner. To our Icelandic murder mystery set on the Spanish island of Tenerife first, I will let its author introduce herself, I think.
Okay, my name is Sunna Valgerðardóttir. In Icelandic, most English speakers pronounce it Sunna Valgerðardóttir.
Full disclosure, Sunna's novel hasn't actually been published yet. She is still in the process of writing it. So, how do I know about it? Well, that's actually because Sunna's originally a journalist by trade, and I have been trying to recruit her as a contributor to Inside Europe, incidentally following a one-man lobbying campaign by listener Pal Olafsson, who is arguing for more coverage of Icelandic stories. Shout out to Pal there, and a reminder that if you email insideeurope@dw.com, we are very likely to take you seriously. Anyway, long story short, Sunna and I got talking, and it emerged that she was in the process of writing a detective fiction novel involving a cast of Icelandic characters on the Spanish island of Tenerife. And it turns out that the Iceland-Tenerife connection is quite a big thing.
The attraction, I think it's a lot of factors. It's in many ways very similar to Iceland's in regards to geology, for example. It has this big volcano, which is the highest mountain in Spain, and it's a small island and very easy to navigate. You can get anything you need at any time, anywhere. The weather is perfect. It's the same time zone as Iceland. It's like, either you love it or you hate it. And there's also a lot of people that, you know, are really proud of, no, I've never been to Tenerife and I'm never going.
The way that British people might claim never to have been to Ibiza, or German people might claim never to have been to Mallorca, because
yes,
there's a sort of a cultural stigma. There's a bit of classism, perhaps,
yes,
even.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
I'm fascinated. So you've got a cast of Icelandic characters on Tenerife.
Yeah. The rule of thumb is write what you know. And I know murder mysteries because I love them. I've loved them ever since I was a child.
An island setting is perfect, right? Because it's a closed pool of people who can be the suspects. Everybody's thrown together. You can't get away.
The working title of the book, it's called Morð um Borð, like murder on board, because the first murder, or maybe the only murder, is committed aboard an airplane, flying from Keflavik, Iceland, to Tenerife.
It has to have been someone on the plane.
Yeah.
And presumably, sorry, just my political brain is sort of going into action here, and I'm thinking, oh, wow, both embassies are going to have to be involved here, right?
Oh, my God. I spent so much time researching who has the jurisdiction and who would do the autopsy. And it just so happens that the boss of the national radio in Iceland, he used to be the chief of police in Reykjavik. So I just called him and asked, like, how would this go down? If a murder was committed on board an Icelandic airplane over the Atlantic Ocean between Iceland and Tenerife, which is like 4,000 kilometers, I think, the Icelandic police would always have jurisdiction, because what happens aboard an Icelandic plane, it's by law in Iceland. And it's also a Christmas story, because the plane lands on the day before Christmas.
I'm so glad that this is a Christmas story, because, you know, if there's one thing that I know about Icelandic Christmases, it's that books are really important, right? You even have a word. There's this tradition on Christmas Eve where people give each other books and then everybody just disappears into their own corner and reads them.
Yeah. We have this also this saying, oh, this word, it's called the Christmas book flood.
Oh, amazing. Say it in Icelandic for me.
Jólabókaflóðið.
Fantastic.
But I mean, you know, seriously, this is a sign, I think, of just how important book culture is for Icelanders, right?
It's really important. I feel like everybody's writing books right now. The amount of Icelandic books that have been published, it's crazy. It's insane. It's not uncommon to get like 7 books for Christmas as presents.
Amazing. This is my kind of country. I'm coming to you for Christmas, Sunna. I hope you realise.
Yeah, come to Jólabókaflóðið.
I'm fascinated. The you know, because you've got this very, very small pool of people who speak Icelandic, and yet you have so many books being written in the language. Is there such a thing as a sort of a typical Icelandic book? Are there sort of characteristics that you could draw generalizations about? How would I recognize one?
We have the Nordic noir genre, which is by far the most popular genre overall, I think, on the top of the bestsellers. You know, we have Yrsa Sigurðardóttir, which she has been. I was in Edinburgh the other day, and I walked into this fancy bookstore on many floors, you know, and there was a whole shelf just with Yrsa Sigurðardóttir books. I think she is the top crime, like Nordic noir, whodunit, murder mystery writer. And then we have Ragnar Jónasson, who is also really big, and Arnaldur Indriðason. These three are like the three, you know, giants in the market for this kind of literature.
But have they set a murder mystery on Tenerife yet?
They have not.
There you are. You heard it first on Inside Europe. Sunna, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Matthew MacDonald is principal double bass of the Berliner Philharmoniker. In other words, one of the world's leading double bass players. He's also a poet and founding editor of Berlin Lit, a digital poetry journal bringing together emerging and established voices from around the world. Arts journalist Brendan O'Shea has been immersing himself in the sonic world of this multifaceted artist and invites us to listen to sound, silence, and the stories in between.
Matthew MacDonald is one of the world's leading double bass players. Since 2009, he's been principal bass of the Berlin Philharmonic, admired for his precision, his warmth, and his unmistakable singing tone. There's another side to this artist, one that also needs rhythm and breath in phrasing and silence, the side of the poet.
Silence in my life, maybe it was hotel rooms, I think. That's where I've felt silence most acutely, being on tour, away from the family and the pets and all the normal noise, and then just being in a quiet room.
For MacDonald, silence isn't an absence. It's a kind of listening, the stillness before something begins. Originally from Canberra, Australia, MacDonald grew up influenced by jazz and rock before turning to classical music. His path led him from Sydney to Berlin, where he joined the Philharmonic's Carillon Academy. From there, he held principal positions with the Danish Radio Orchestra and Frankfurt's Ensemble Moderne, until in 2009, when he became the principal bass of the Berlin Phil. As his musical life deepened, another form of expression called to him, and during the pandemic, he completed a master's in creative writing through the Open University, exploring how rhythm, language, and performance could meet on the page.
When I write, of course, there's the attention to rhythm and sound, which is, you know, inherently musical. But I think what is similar is the act of writing can be so thrilling. The adrenaline rush of being in the middle of writing a poem that's working can be just as strong for me as being on stage playing a symphony or concerto.
It's a powerful admission that the same energy that drives a Mahler symphony can live inside a few lines of verse. Both demand that leap into sound, into instinct.
In that way that you're a little bit outside of yourself, in music, when it's going well, you're not thinking about the technique or where to put your fingers or how to move the bow. You're just observing almost from above, and this feeling like the conscious mind would get in the way if you were to use it. And there's this joy of keeping it at bay for as long as possible. And similar with writing, when it's going really well and you just don't want to get your reasoning, conscious mind mixed up, because you know as soon as you do that, something will go wrong. So it's this also just flight from the self in a way, kind of outer body almost, that a good performance and a good writing session has.
There's something meditative about the way Matthew MacDonald describes it, that delicate balance between control and surrender. The craft is technical, yes, but the art, that lives somewhere just outside of reach.
And I remember my first kind of pieces where I thought, oh, I'm onto something here, were when I wasn't trying to sound like what I thought a poem should sound like. It's also about getting to know yourself in a way, which is so nice, or at least a part of yourself. And being true to that part of myself has helped me write much better poems.
A moment of clarity, when imitation falls away and the artist starts hearing their own voice. For MacDonald, that discovery wasn't just literary. It deepened how he played too. It was inevitable the two worlds would meet. His poem, Grand Partita, begins with the sound of air rushing through a concert hall, a strange kind of music competing with the one on stage.
A concert hall is a mason jar, almost airtight, good for preserving old music in briny sweetness. One hall had a worn seal, critical to airtight conditions, Air rushed out through the gap between doors. The wind howled louder than the winds on stage. The sound, sad choir of ghosts, the sound of one kind of air competing with another, is mentioned in the review. In Salzburg, I received bad, bad news, but I am highly professional. The following days I played Mozart, the Requiem. The piece that in the film Amadeus tortured Mozart to compose was torturing me to hear, and the river surged through Salzburg, towards and away from Canberra, which has no river as chalky, green and wide as the Salzach, but had a death that made the hills of wild garlic and gift shop signs in the Getreidegasse, and the dark face of the mountain behind Festival Hall, all seemed to lean in its general direction, and the choir sang Lacrimosa, the text of which means 3 days have passed without alteration. You have to book a flight home. I think poetry is a, for me, it's a bit of a luck and inspiration thing. It's not something you can just sit down and do for 3 hours every day. For me, it's very random. And then I wanted to still be involved with poetry, getting my hands dirty with poetry in any way I could. And I thought editing a magazine, kind of compiling an issue of poems, was a really great way to do that. And it was, and I learned so much. I've learned so much doing it.
In 2022, MacDonald founded Berlin Lit, a digital poetry journal. Based in Berlin, but international in spirit, it brings together new and established voices, with writing that moves easily between continents, languages, and styles. And interestingly, each issue feels a bit like a small concert program that's been carefully curated, quietly adventurous, and always searching for emotional truth. For MacDonald, Berlin Lit is more than a publication. It's a way of staying tuned to the wider conversation, of keeping the poetic current flowing, even when the double bass takes centre stage.
We hadn't expected to get a table so soon. Menu long and confusing. The food kept coming in the wrong order. Dessert came first, and we thought the meal was done. Lol. But then steaks. So many more than we'd ordered. Some rare, some well done. And then more dessert, which also tasted a bit steaky. Then no food at all, just wine. We turned our attention to the song in the background, and bam, out of nowhere, more steaks. We loaded a trailer with 300 doggy bags of steaks. For a long time, it was all we ate.
But in the end, Matt MacDonald says it all circles back to listening, to the strangeness of everyday life, to the rhythm of the world as it hums along quietly.
I mean, also when I'm going about the place, just daily life is a very strange place. There are so many strange things that happen, and all the strange things that happen I kind of collect and know I'll use at some point later.
If you want even more of Matthew MacDonald, he has a book out in January. The title is Grand Partita, and the publisher, rather wonderfully, is Moist Books. You're listening to Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock in Bonn, calling time for now on our literature special because we have something very different coming up next. Regular listeners to the show may remember that our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay, recently reported on a cycling festival being held in the hometown of Slovenian cycling legend Tadej Pogacar. That really wasn't that long ago. So why are we ending the show with another Pogacar story? Well, I'm going to read you Guy's pitch. The idea is for Pogacar to give me and around 1,000 other no-hopers a head start, then chase us up a mountain. This is happening on 12th of October at my local ski spot, which Pogacar says is his favourite climb in cycling. I've gone down it on skis, but never ridden up it on a bike. How could we say no to that?
Hundreds of people have crammed into a marquee here in Tadej Pogacar's home village, Komenda. They're watching the four-time Tour de France champion ride his way to victory in his penultimate race of the season, the Giro di Lombardia. But less than 24 hours from now, many of us will be setting off ahead of him on the climb up Mount Karvavec for an event called the Poggy Challenge. This is going
to you guys tomorrow. To ride a bike with him or he with the fans, That's all what he wants, and yeah, that's sort of idea.
Luca Dolar is part of the team behind the Poggy Challenge.
It's really simple. He doesn't want to have a big reception or a big party in the center of Ljubljana or I don't know. He wants to show where he is from and to do what he most likes.
The chance to ride with Tadej Pogacar is a big deal and it's attracted global attention. The start list includes riders from 36 countries. One of them is Tang Li, who's brought his rather lovely S-Works tarmac bike from China's southern Guangdong province.
I just arrived.
So you're jet-lagged?
Yeah. I flew 25 hours to get here. Only reason, the man, Tadej Pogacar. Yeah, he's the man.
What's the appeal of Tadej Pogacar to people like you and other people in China?
Always attacking, always going forward, no looking back. Yeah, that's why we like him.
Even if you like him a lot, Tang, it seems like an awful long way to come.
Yeah.
Just to say that you like the guy.
My wife say, he said to me, like, if you don't go, you will regret for the rest of your lifetime. I say, okay, yeah. Then we book the ticket.
Let's rewind a couple of weeks, because that's when I got my invitation to take part in the Poggy Challenge. Not just reporting, but riding up the fearsome 15-kilometre climb ahead of the world's greatest male cyclist. Which is a bit of a problem, because my usual cycling is just around town, not up an actual mountain. So, is this a really silly idea?
Yeah, that could be quite stupid, of course.
Mark Kohe is a former sporting director for one of the world's top women's cycling teams.
But on the other hand, it's also a unique opportunity to measure yourself with Tadej Pogacar, the absolute best in cycling, and even historically speaking, there hasn't been anyone that good in this sport. So, it's really special, yeah.
What can I do to prepare myself for this sort of, not just racing against Tadej Pogacar, but going up a climb this fearsome?
Well, not much, actually. I mean, you can't really improve your shape that much in that sort of period, so the only thing you can do is prepare your body for the shock that it's waiting. Try to climb as much as you can in this period, so that on the day of the event, the shock isn't that big. Tore, tore, tore!
Hundreds of cyclists are already at the start line for this Poggi challenge, and I have to say most of them look a lot more professional than I do. This is going to be one of the most intimidating climbs in all of Slovenia, but what makes it particularly intimidating is that you're doing it in the company of the greatest rider that I have ever seen.
I hope that I won't be last.
Anja Litjen won her ticket to ride the Poggi challenge in a radio competition.
I think he's a really nice guy, really, really down to earth, really nice to people, to all the spectators. And yeah, this is what I liked about him.
What do you think he does for the country?
Yeah, I think that now a lot of people from around the world really knows where Slovenia is and that this is not Slovakia.
Thank you all for coming and enjoy today. Have fun. Have fun.
Well, we're off. The climb is about to start. Go. There are too many people wearing world champion jerseys. How will I know when it's Tadej Pogacar? And there he goes. Tadej Pogacar just whooshed past me. That didn't take long.
Poggi passed me within the first 2 kilometres, which was pretty much what I expected. But I was in good company, because despite the head start, only one challenger stayed ahead of the champion until the misty mountaintop finish, 40-year-old British lawyer Andrew Feather.
I can walk away today and say, you know, I've shaken his hand, he's given me the trophy, which is amazing.
What were you thinking as you were going up this climb? And it is relentless. Were you bracing yourself for the moment that you saw that rainbow jersey flash past?
I was looking, particularly towards the end, on the steep bit, I was looking over my shoulder thinking at some point he's going to come up pretty quick, but he didn't, so I was just, yeah, I was happy. And it was amazing, there were so many people at the end watching, the crowds were so big. It was like a, you know, Tour de France stage finish, and it certainly gave me the motivation to keep going all the way to the line.
Hello, hello, welcome to the finish line, good job, good job.
In fact, today was very much in party mode and even seemed happy that someone had beaten him. Perhaps it was the novelty after one of the greatest individual seasons of all time, or just relief that he'll finally get a holiday.
It means a lot to finish the season with an event like this, I think, as a thank you to all the people.
You didn't win for once.
Yeah, you cannot win them all.
It's an Englishman who beat you.
Yeah, he's climbing very good, eh?
What's next for you, though? Because you've conquered everything this year, more or less. How do you keep yourself interested?
If you love what you do, then motivation shouldn't be difficult to search for. I'm pretty open for anything.
That sounds rather ominous to me. Potential Poggi challengers, consider yourselves warned. Guy Delaunay, DW, on top of Mount Kervavets.
Guy, you may have lost that one, but losing to Pogacar counts as a win in my book. Inside Europe has a win of its own to announce. We've taken away silver at the 2025 Signal Podcast Awards for our special episode, Grief, a Catalyst for Social Change, featuring the ideas of author Sarah Jaffe and the reporting of Dan Ashby and Angelo van Schaik. We didn't win the Listener's Choice Award, but thank you so much to everyone who voted. It meant a lot to us, and we particularly appreciated your messages of support. That's it for today. This programme was produced by me, Kate Laycock, and Laura Kabelka. Our sound engineer was Gerd Georgi, assisted by Ilias Katsamakas. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.